This is Steps to Recovery, the History of AA, a special project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. According to a recent survey, over 10% of Americans wrestle with drinking problems, but over 4 in 10 adults have a family history of alcohol abuse or full-blown alcoholism. And for kids being raised in these conditions, it can leave emotional scars. I talked with Aiden, working for an insurance broker in Massachusetts.
My mother would come home from her second job, she would start drinking, and my dad just would come home from work because he would have gone to a local tavern or pub or whatever, and I'd be doing my homework because I had to maintain those perfect grades, constantly striving for my parents' approval. And it would be like 11:30, 12 o'clock, and my mother would notice that my father wasn't home, and she'd get really upset, and she made it my problem. So I knew every phone number for every bar in the town we lived in by heart, and I would call around, mind you, 12 or 13 years old, and I would find out where my father was, and I would take my mother's keys, and I would drive in our minivan however many miles to go and collect my father. Now, I was not licensed to drive. I was underage.
For alcoholics who are not in recovery from addiction, young people in their lives often get drawn into the twisted family dynamics.
I enabled that situation. You know, that was a situation between my parents. My mother could have located my father. She could have let him stay out all night drinking. He could have gotten arrested for a DUI, driving himself home drunk. He could have gotten into a cab. But instead, I drove illegally, would collect my father. I would have the bouncer put him in the vehicle because by then he was completely trashed. I would drive him home. I would carry him in the house. I would get him undressed and put him in bed.
So when you were 12 and 13 going through that, did you have a sense that this was simply an unfair burden for a person that age to be carrying?
Absolutely. I was very angry. I knew it wasn't legal. I knew it wasn't right. And I knew that if I got caught, I was going to get in trouble and my parents weren't. I knew that. There was no doubt in my mind that I was the scapegoat. But I'd always, that was my role in the family. It was always, everything was my fault. You know, that was the message that I got from day one. If you weren't such a bad little girl, we wouldn't drink.
So are you now in a place where you can feel that the behavior of parents who were going through those kinds of problems is not your fault, that you're not to blame for it?
One of the most powerful things I've learned is the 3 C's. I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it. And the day that that light bulb turned on for me and I really realized that it had nothing to do with me and my parents were sick and suffering was one of the most liberating days of my life. Hurt people hurt people. You know, my parents weren't mean to me or critical of me or abusive towards me because I deserved it. That was a manifestation of their illness. You know, I didn't blame my mother when she got cancer for throwing up all over me after chemo treatment. That was a symptom of her disease. Similarly, my parents not teaching me an appropriate level of responsibility for my age or not providing me with a healthy environment for my age was a very extreme, mind you, but it was a symptom of their disease.
So you're not excusing their behavior?
Absolutely not, but I can understand. I can love the alcoholic and hate the disease. I can separate the fact that my parents loved me in their own sick, dysfunctional way and that I deserve better from them. But I also recognize that every day they were fighting a battle that I myself am fortunate enough not to have to fight myself. I know that the things I did that were inappropriate or wrong or unhealthy were things that were a product of that situation. If my parents hadn't been alcoholics or they hadn't been actively drinking, those situations probably never would have happened.
For families and individuals trapped in addiction, AA has long offered a way out.
Alcoholics Anonymous research was not super strong methodologically for many decades.
Keith Humphreys is professor of psychiatry at Stanford University.
But in the last 20 years or so, there's been a large number of rigorous studies, longitudinal studies that follow people over time. And what those studies have shown has been very positive, that, you know, people who go to AA on average drink less than people who don't go. They're more likely to overcome other problems like depression, like social isolation, and so forth. And that has, you know, changed the minds of all people who listen to science from skepticism to a positive attitude about Alcoholics Anonymous.
Humphreys cautions, though, that AA is not for everyone. Some people just can't handle participating in a group, even on an anonymous basis, or they need the structure of a professional intervention rather than AA's easygoing atmosphere of equals helping each other. But because AA charges no dues or fees, and its meetings can be found in nearly every town, it does appeal to a broad community of people seeking to gain a victory over alcohol problems.
Could have only come out of the American 1930s, after the crash of 1929 and the Great Depression taking effect. For the first time, this go-get-em, optimistic American culture hit bottom.
Ernest Kurtz wrote Not God, A History of Alcoholics Anonymous.
You know, here were these people who had been titans of business and doing very well, and suddenly they were rummaging through garbage pails outside of restaurants, and the restaurants were cooking food even though there was no one there. Some, you know, they're trying to put on this illusion that everything's okay when really it wasn't. And this suffused the culture. The Great Depression, people were depressed, really. People who had been used to controlling things learned that they were powerless. And I think it was this clash, really, that first discovered AA, that level of business. People who had to confront their powerlessness. So to me, AA could have only come out of the American 1930s. I mean, this is the era out of which neo-Orthodox thought comes in the theology that goes on to the Niebuhrs, the recognition of powerlessness. There are other threads that go on at this time. This is the culture.
The medical profession at that time was largely perplexed and unable to solve the heartbreaking puzzle of addiction that had wreaked havoc in so many families. The proliferation of rehabs for alcoholics and drug addicts would not occur for several decades, and the stigma attached to alcoholism required that the recovery movement in its infancy function discreetly, without public fanfare, without use of members' last names. But upon the first publication of the Big Book in 1939, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous slowly took off.
AA grew by one person talking to another.
The late Nell Wing, Bill Wilson's longtime personal secretary and the official archivist, recalled the exciting initial spurts of AA's growth.
The spread of AA is a fascinating story. In the earliest days, before we had the book, they felt you had to talk personally to another person. After the book came out, the first group that started from just reading the book was in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we said, oh, that's great, because one member wrote in for the book, read it, talked to other people. Before you knew it, there was two or three people. It was a group. And that was a very, very encouraging and pep Bill up and everybody up no end, because that meant then you didn't have to, by personal contact, start AA anywhere. You could do it by letter and telling them, sending them the book. And this started then all over the world. Hawaii, you know, I mean, you had a group in Houston, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. There was always a little rivalry about who was the first group there. There was a salesman who sold window shades to bars, bar rooms, whose territory is up and down the East Coast, who he'd write to us, would say, look, somebody wants help, so-and-so. He'd take the book and visit them personally, and one thing would, of course, lead to another. So finally, you got a network of various kinds of people. There were people in embassies around in Sweden and Mexico, members carrying the message to at least other Americans at that time.
A seminal contribution of Alcoholics Anonymous has been to set forth the principles of recovery enumerated in the 12 steps. The steps are brief and deceptively simple, but they are rich in meaning. Thousands of AA groups study them in depth each week. The steps of recovery offer a carefully sequenced process of self-reflection, of spiritual growth, of repairing relationships harmed while in the grip of addiction, and of developing a new, healthier life. Historian Bill S.
Well, the origin of the 12 steps is there's a lot of places where the 12 steps came from. Certainly, a lot of the practices that led to the 12 steps originated in the Oxford group. The need for confession, the need for making of amends to people that you have harmed, the need for complete honesty, the need for meditation and prayer. All of those things came out of the Oxford group.
And the steps also were inspired by the world's great spiritual traditions, which held a deep interest for both of AA's co-founders. Bill Wilson was a big fan of William James' groundbreaking book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, published in 1902. Dr. Bob was a serious student of spiritual philosophy, which he would expound on at length. But neither man was religious in a conventional sense.
And they started opening themselves to other ideas and other things that might help them stay sober. It's a very practical program. And Wilson was interested in what worked. And after a couple of years of this, what he decided what worked was what he finally formulated in December of 1938 into the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Bill Wilson wrote two long versions of the Bill's story, his autobiographical story that appears in the big book. As I read both of those stories down in the archive for the first time, I realized that 11 of the 12 steps were almost explicitly, using almost exactly the same language, almost they were explicitly in those stories. So as he was telling the story of his recovery and the message that was brought to him by Abby Thatcher from the Oxford group, what he had to do to stay sober, those things are in fact right there in that May 1938 story that he wrote. He later extrapolated out of that somehow, and he claims when he numbered them, found them to be 12.
We're exploring the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, which has helped tens of millions of people recover from addiction since its founding in 1935. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. To learn more about the 12 steps of AA, and to obtain an audio download or CD of this documentary, Steps to Recovery, The History of AA, please visit humanmedia.org. The core concept of AA's 12 steps is the alcoholic's utter hopelessness. By admitting complete defeat, alcoholics finally face their absolute inability to control this bedeviling problem through sheer willpower. That may seem counterintuitive, but the principle of personal powerlessness lays the foundation for reliance on a higher power. If I can't fix this, I need to plug into a power source that can. In AA, that's the moment of letting go. It's when the refreshing breeze of recovery can waft in. Over the years, we've talked on an anonymous basis with a variety of people who've used the AA program to heal.
You know, I wrote a fourth step, a moral inventory of myself. And that was really scary, you know, because to someone who ran and hid for so long, you know, to sit there and take an honest look at themselves is really hard. It's a really humbling process. All of the steps are. Admitting complete defeat is humbling. Believing that there's a power greater than myself, you know, that's humbling too, because that means that I'm not, you know, I'm not all that. I'm not the greatest power on this earth, you know, and that's pretty grandiose to say that, but for a long time I felt that way, you know. I had this huge ego, you know, even though I felt that I was worthless, you know, at times I felt like everything was about me, you know, the whole world revolved around me. That's how I saw things, and, you know, I had to let go of that. Turning my will and my life over to a higher power is extremely humbling, you know. That means I'm not necessarily going to get what I want when I want it. I may not get what I want at all. You know, there's a power out there that knows better than I do, and that's going to help me.
I like the idea of a higher power. I didn't, I'd had some difficulty with churches and with the formal religions. I'd had difficulty with them. So the higher power appealed to me. I can accept that, that there's always something higher than we are and higher than I am.
There's some people who insist that that is nothing more nor less than a rather conventional god, white of skin and bearded and male. There are a great many other people who simply say that the important thing is not that you believe in a personal god of any kind, but that you know that you yourself are not God and don't try to fill that role.
Higher power with me, I understand the whole concept of it. I have a little more difficult time with it. I don't know if it's because I'm still real new in the program or what. I haven't felt a spiritual awakening yet. I know that I haven't done this on my own.
Any alcoholic, if he would get them through his denial enough to realize this, of course he has been putting his life in the hands of a higher power all during his drinking, because eventually the alcohol becomes the all-powerful thing in his life, and his whole life is in the hands, really, of the alcohol. And so in AA, why, he has to, you know, come through that and find some other higher power other than the bottle that he can turn his life over to.
I stood in my own way. I did not surrender to the reality of what my alcoholism was doing to me. I kept fighting to continue to drink the way other people drank. I was a perfectly normal, intelligent person. Why couldn't I do that? That's arrogance for you.
Trying to let go, you know, this simple phrase, let go and let God, that's tough. That really is tough. You know, I give up. You do something, God. Partly, I think, modern man has been persuaded since the French theorists in the 18th century to try to be rational and think that he can do things himself. Can control things. And I think that's part of the something that's built into the culture in more or less civilized society. And we seem to be finding out that it doesn't always work that way, that we can't control things.
Early sobriety was one of the hardest things I ever did, you know. The obsession to drink and to drug was so strong within me, you know, and every cell of my body wanted to drink and drug, but just there was something inside that knew, you know, that I needed to stay sober. And, you know, I was praying. I didn't have any faith when I first started praying, you know, but I started seeing results, you know, little by little. You know, I was 30 days sober, you know, and then next thing I knew I was 60 days sober, you know, and just to me that's an absolute miracle, you know. But I still had all these feelings, and I was forced to feel them. I didn't have my crutch anymore, you know. I could have looked for other things outside myself to make me feel better, you know. But I just, something inside, I just knew that wasn't the way to go, you know. I knew I had to surrender. And it was really hard, you know. For my first month, I didn't have any feelings. I was still kind of out of it. But probably for the next 2 months, you know, I was crying every night because it hurt so bad.
Your reliance upon a higher power is the bedrock of your sobriety. And I came into the program on blind faith when I watched how it worked in other people's lives. And my faith today is backed by experience, and I see how it works.
Thank you.
Alcoholics Anonymous functions at the grassroots level, where each individual group, usually consisting of a few dozen people, operates autonomously. Typically, they pass a basket to pay rent at the church or wherever they meet, and to buy the books and coffee, but that's about the extent of high finance in AA. By tradition, the meetings stay out of politics, avoid religious arguments and commercial endorsements, avoid anything but helping drunks. There are local and national AA offices where lists of individual meetings are maintained for public access, where the AA literature is made available, where phones are answered. But amazingly, no one actually runs Alcoholics Anonymous, and these traditions are widely followed.
I've been sober since December 1981.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I got sober when I was 38, so you can do the math on that.
Bill S., the historian we've heard earlier, is a faithful attender of several weekly AA meetings in the Fairfield, Connecticut area where he lives and works. He also volunteers considerable time to serving as a sponsor, an informal recovery partner for other members of the AA Fellowship.
I was early on, maybe 3 weeks out of rehab, and I was at a meeting, a men's meeting, my Monday night men's meeting, and I was, I know exactly where I was standing, and my sponsor was introducing me to people, and they were all very happy guys, and I thought to myself, you know what, I'm going to do whatever I have to do to become a part of this group. Now, for a guy who had been a self-proclaimed and an actual loner his entire life, I hadn't joined anything. I thought people who needed to join thing were kind of weak people. And all of a sudden, I found myself standing there thinking, I want to be a part of this. And that was certainly a critical, key, and important spiritual awakening for me to have.
Making the connection with others.
Making the connection with others. I went from an individualistic approach to life to a communal approach to life. And I still live within that community.
I know that you have personally served as a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you describe that relationship?
My home group, the Stratford Men's Group, is very strong on sponsorship. I have a sponsor. I have two sponsors at the moment. And I sponsor a bunch of men myself. My wife tells me too many, but it's just the way it goes sometimes. I sponsor, 15 guys, I think, these days. And it's a responsibility that I take very seriously. I turn to my sponsors for help and advice with real regularity. And I try and give that same sort of support and advice and help going in the other direction.
And do these consist of sort of one-on-one conversations?
Yeah, they're one-on-one conversations. These days, those are phone calls. I get a lot of phone calls during the day. And most of those people I see at meetings. So I not only talk to them on the phone, but I run into them at meetings. I see all of those people. I go to 4 meetings a week, and I see people that I sponsor somewhere in each of those 4 meetings. It's one of the requirements for people I sponsor. I have to see in a meeting. And then, of course, with the modern technology, we also do emails, we do texts.
And people wonder why it is after decades of abstinence from alcohol you would feel the need to continue attending AA meetings. Are you fighting off a craving that rears its head sometimes?
The desire to drink is something that doesn't really go away, but it's certainly with me it's lessened over the years, over the decades. When I was first sober, it used to rear its ugly head every 30 minutes. And these days, it doesn't happen all that often. But every so often, I get one of those blank spots Wilson talked about, where I'll be sitting at a table having dinner with 6 people, and 2 of them are drinking red wine, and it's a great Bordeaux, and I can smell it. And I think, God, I just love that. Boy, maybe I should just try that. I haven't had that particular vintage. So that does happen.
But today you don't yield to that temptation. What is the shield that protects you from having a slip, having a relapse?
Well, David, everybody's different on this, I think. My particular shield has always been the people that I've grown close to in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my particular shield. It's very clear to me that the way my psychology works is other people are keeping me sober.
Listening to Humankind, I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Antonio Oliart Rose. Editorial assistance from Mark Hilstein, Kathy Graham, and Bond Collard. Webmaster Brian K. Johnson. Special thanks to Tony Buck. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with Connie Goldman Productions. Program development provided by Short Media.
To download an audio copy of this program and access other resources, please visit humanmedia.org. That's humanmedia.org. You can also access our other programs and send us an email from our website. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org.
And you can subscribe to our free weekly podcast, Humankind on Public Radio. This segment, Steps to Recovery, the History of AA, is Humankind program number 225.
The executive producer is David Freudberg. This is Humankind.